Welcome to Bush and Company's War on Civil Liberties and What It Means for Our Future. I'm Michael Smith. I'm going to chair the panel, and I'm going to introduce my co-panelists. I have a few observations to make, and then I'll turn it over to John. This is John Ehrenberg. He's the chairman of the Political Science Department at Long Island University. And John has written a book called Servants of Wealth, which gave us the idea of doing something slightly different this year. You know, we've been having a panel on the crash of civil liberties since 9/11. We want to give it a slightly different focus this year, and that's why John was nice enough to agree to join us. And the focus that we want to give it this year is that civil liberties don't exist in the abstract. There's a class struggle out there, and that without civil liberties, our side isn't going to make much gains. And we want to talk about what kind of tools have now been developed to use against us in case that struggle heats up. And John is going to talk about that aspect of it. But still, in the last year since we had the Left Forum, things have gone from bad to worse in terms of legislation and government practice. And those will be covered both by Dalia Hashad and by Vince Warren. Dalia is the head of the American program for Amnesty International. She came up today from Washington to be on the panel. Prior to Dalia taking that job, she was the head for the American Civil Liberties Union of their Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian outreach. You remember what happened after 9/11. It was kind of on a little bit lesser scale of what they did to the Japanese after Pearl Harbor. And Dalia was the person at the ACLU who was going around the country exposing that and speaking about it. Vince Warren also was at the ACLU, and for the last, what, 6 months?
6 months.
6 months has been the new executive director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Congratulations. And I'm on the board of the center, and we were all thrilled that Vince agreed to take the job. The center is like the meanest, toughest small dog on the block, and the really kick-ass litigation that's gone on, for the most part, has been the litigation of the center. And Vince is in charge of running that place, so that stuff keeps going. And I just wanted to say one thing about myself. Dalia and I, and Michael Ratner, who's the president of the center, and Heidi Boghossian, who's the executive director of the Lawyers Guild, have a radio program on WBAI called Law and Disorder. It's 99.5 on Monday at 10 o'clock. It's a one-hour magazine program, and for the last almost 3 years, we've attempted to chronicle the crash of civil liberties since 9/11. We also have a website, lawanddisorder.org, and all the programs that we've put on are on that website. Jeff Brady is our producer, standing up there with the camera. He's in charge of the website. It's a good website. So if you want a good resource, you could check that out. We also have links on the website to Amnesty International and to the center, and to other things. So I wanted to start off by announcing two victories, and then go into a kind of a theoretical overview of how I see what's happened in the last 5 years here. And I'll speak for about 5-6 minutes. We've got two victories against Ashcroft that we should revel in. You remember Ashcroft was the Attorney General, the first Attorney General under Bush. And Ashcroft, two of his pet projects in trying to increase the fear level were the indictment of Lynn Stewart and the indictment of Mohamed Salah in Chicago. The Lynn Stewart case, they were successful beyond their wildest dreams. They got her convicted of everything. They overcharged her, and the jury came back. The jury was scared to death, and I mean, for good reason. They had pictures of bin Laden on the wall as big as this wall. They had the cops bring the jury into the courtroom every day. And they just kept going on terrorism. She had nothing to do with terrorism. They tried her with a guy that arguably did. And they were able to make an amalgam between that guy and her, scare the jury, railroaded the jury. Jury came back and found her guilty of all accounts. And the government, this is Fitzgerald, is the prosecutor, top prosecutor. He's the guy that just recently accomplished the cover-up with Cheney by just going after Libby. And he also is the prosecutor of Mohammed Salah in Chicago. But in any case, the government, through Fitzgerald, recommended that Lynn, who's a couple years older than I am, I think she's 67, and they wanted to put her in prison for 30 years. So, you know, it wasn't any help for us to tell her just do it a day at a time. She'd be out when she's 97. And it was looking pretty grim. Liz Fink came in at that point as the attorney on the sentencing, wrote a brilliant brief outlined for the judge who Lynn Stewart was. And the judge was impressed. And instead of giving her the 30 years, he gave her 28 months. With time off, you get 15% off kind of automatically if you don't get into trouble. So if she has to serve 2 years, this was the greatest reduction of a sentence in the history of the United States. 94% reduction. You don't see that happen very often. The judge credited her with her kind of selfless community work in her legal career, particularly with the black community, over the last 25 years, and did that for her. Well, the government didn't sit still for that. Now, they've appealed the sentence. You know, you've got a right to appeal a sentence. And it's up on appeal now. So her defense committee is still active. There's literature downstairs, and she needs help. But that was a good victory over Ashcroft. The second victory over Ashcroft took place last month in Chicago with the vindication of Mohammed Salah. The case was covered all over the place in the Chicago papers. Didn't get much. People know what I'm talking about here? It didn't get much coverage here. It was one of the major terrorist cases in the Ashcroft administration. It was brought to show that Hamas also has terrorist cells in the United States, you know, to try to justify the whole scare campaign. Salah was a Chicago businessman with a wife and three kids, active in his mosque, active in charitable work, went over to Israel in the mid-90s with some money to give to Palestinians who'd been expelled from their homes. And it gave the money to Hamas. Hamas at that time was not on the terrorist list. Hamas actually was partly a creation of Israel, who were looking to set up a religious organization that would undercut the secular left organizations that the Palestinians were supportive of. So Hamas was set up. This is not to denigrate Hamas, but Hamas was kind of kosher at the time. And he went over and gave Hamas this money. Israelis picked him up, tortured him for how many days, Dahlia?
He was held for about 80 days.
Yeah.
The first time around, 80 days to, you know, then again, 90 days.
Tortured, forced to sign a confession that he was a terrorist in Hebrew, a language, of course, which he doesn't read. And interestingly enough, during his questioning, it's like a bad penny, Judy Miller. Judy Miller is friends with the Prime Minister of Israel. Israel wants to scare Americans to get more support to show that Hamas has terror cells in the United States. So they get Judy Miller into the interrogation room to watch this guy being questioned. And of course, it's a Potemkin village at that time. You know, they're nice to him. He'd already been broken in spirit. And she writes back, comes back and writes in the Times, just like the crap that she wrote in the build-up to war in Iraq, she writes that the Israelis were nice with him and this guy's a terrorist and so on and so on. She was called as a witness at the trial. The trial took 2.5 months. It concluded a couple weeks ago. The jury was out for 2.5 weeks. The main defense counsel is Michael Deutsch, who used to be the head of the litigation department at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Deutsch and his firm, the People's Law Office, they took the case. Deutsch summed up to the jury with the whole history of the Palestinian liberation struggle since the general strike of the Palestinians in 1936. He won the jury over. The jury had seven black people on it. And in Chicago, remember, Chicago was the home of the Nation of Islam. So you don't scare people about Muslims as easily in Chicago. And this jury was not scared. And they came back and they totally vindicated Mohammed Salah. Salah went down to the press conference after the verdict, talked to 200 people at the press. Oh, and he was convicted of one minor thing, of lying on an interrogatory, nothing. It's like community service. So he comes down to the press conference and he says, if they give me community service, I want the judge to put me in the Jewish community. So he's a good guy. He just undercut all this crap. So Ashcroft now is 0 for 2 in the last couple months. Ashcroft retired and is doing, I think, what is it, Debbie? Public relations work, and he's bragging about how much money he's making. But his legacy is coming undone. And we'll see in retrospect that this whole terror scare was as fake as the Red Scare of the 50s. It's starting to come undone. That's the good news I wanted to announce. But let me shift gears now and talk about what I think is really quite worrisome. And those are the developments over the last year. You know, there's never been a technology that's been invented that hasn't been used. They invented gunpowder and they used it. They invented the atomic bomb and they used it. And they've now invented technology that can accelerate the capacity of a police state beyond anything we ever imagined. See Jeff nodding, because Jeff was the one who called our attention to this book, Spy Chips, which is getting a lot of play. There's now a device called radio frequency identification chip. Ever hear of it?
Yeah.
They're putting it in all our passports now. And they've just passed a law which requires a national ID, and eventually they're going to put it in driver's license, all driver's license. So with this gizmo, it can be read passively when you walk past something, and it tells the reader who you are. It tells them your whole governmental history, your medical history, your personal commercial history, where you are. If you're with somebody else, it tells you who you're with, right? And this technology is being used globally. The United States is working closely with the G8 countries, all the countries of Europe and Canada and Japan, so that this is going to be an international system that they want to put in place. What's wrong with all of this? Well, the theory of democracy, it was developed in the 18th century. You know, if you go back to your political science class and you read John Locke, or you read Jefferson or Madison, was that you're supposed to have government from the bottom up, that you have free citizens who can talk to each other, who can associate with each other, who have anonymity. Very important concept for democracy, anonymity, so the government doesn't know who you are. And then, after this discussion about what you think your interests are, you elect a representative government, and that government isn't necessarily legitimate. If it starts doing stuff you don't want, you can get rid of it. You can make a revolution. That's in the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson wrote it, right? That was the theory. Now, Marxists would say that that's all well and good, but it's a perverted concept, because you have to also introduce the system of privilege and class, so that democracy isn't really true democracy. There's other forces working on it. That's true also. Nevertheless, at least in its beginning stages, this kind of bourgeois democracy was a big step forward for humanity. This is something now that I think is no longer the situation. And something else very bad has been developing, and since 9/11 has been accelerated. And that's what I want to talk about and conclude my remarks. Preemption. The war in Iraq was a preemptive war, remember? That they had weapons of mass destruction, and before they could use them on us, we were going to take them out.
That's a totally illegal concept in international law. That's not why the United Nations was set up. You can't do a preemptive war. But nonetheless, that was the theory of the Bush people. And they have the same theory applied to us, to terrorism, to risk. They have a zero tolerance for risk. This is their theory, zero tolerance for risk. So they don't proceed from where John Locke would have proceeded with the rights of individuals up to a representative government. They proceed from exactly the opposite, theoretically, with the rights of the government, you know, and who the government represents in this country, we know. The rights of the government for its security. And anything that threatens that security, no matter how obliquely or minimally, is considered a risk, and they have a right to preempt it. I'll give you an example of how they preempted a risk. There was a fellow named Maher Arar, a Canadian. You know about this case? Who was transiting through JFK to get home to Canada. He had been born in Syria. He left Syria when he was 17 years old. It had nothing to do with Syria. Syria is a country which, according to the United States State Department, tortures people. So he's in JFK trying to get back to Canada. The Canadians had been monitoring somebody who Maher Arar knew. And in fact, Maher Arar had lunch with this person's brother, because Maher Arar wanted to buy a PC, and this person's brother knew about computers, so they went out to lunch together to talk about computers. This came to the attention of the Mounties in Canada. And Maher Arar then became a, quote, person of interest. Now, the Canadian government was bulldozed into totally supporting the American government after 9/11 because of the commercial relations that the two countries have. So the Mounties and the FBI are tight, and they're totally cooperated, and the Canadians are falling all over themselves to try to cooperate with the United States. So when this guy goes through passport control and they find out who he is, and they check with the Canadians say it's a person of interest. The United States now wants to find out more about them because they want to preempt any kind of risk, right? Any kind, even minimal. And they render the guy to Syria, where he's kept in a grave that's 7 feet high and 3 feet wide and 6 feet long for over a year, and where he's tortured for over a year. And the United States did this to him. The Canadians, when the story started to come out, were horrified about the complicity of their government in what happened to their fellow citizen. And they had a commission investigate it all. And the commission recommended that he be exonerated and that he be compensated. So he was given last month $9 million U.S. What did the United States do? They've refused to even apologize, which is totally consistent with the notion of preemption, because from their point of view, they did nothing wrong, right? They have zero tolerance for any kind of risk. Well, that's the kind of mentality coupled with the technology they have that we're now living under. And that, in my opinion, isn't going to change. The New York Times had, a week ago Sunday, a wish list on their editorial page. Did you see it? It was almost a page long of everything they'd like to have changed. None of that's going to be changed with my prediction, except maybe the habeas corpus stuff that they outlawed in the Military Commission Act. They may change that. And the only way this stuff is going to get changed, it's going to get changed in passing through a huge upsurge of the movement in this country if that happens. That's the only way it's going to be changed. If there's a million people and they won't give you a permit, a million people constitute its own permit. It's going to be that kind of thing that's going to change it. Meanwhile, they've been very effective in lowering the standard of living and people's expectations. It's been a huge campaign, and John's going to talk about that. And then I want you to think about the implication of what they've been doing to reduce the American way of life. And the connection between that and civil liberties and the kind of representative government I talked about. So with that, I'm going to conclude and ask John to pick up from there. And then Vince is going to speak and Dahlia. Thank you.
Can you repeat the name of that group?